The basket or bowl in the front is simply to pay the rent. If you've got a few bucks to throw in there, that would be helpful. I don't take money for teaching. Your money goes to keep us in this place. If you were thinking of donating more than a few dollars to the bowl, I would ask instead that you give your money to Doctors Without Borders, which is an organization that is helping out with the treatment of the sick and injured in Haiti. So I don't, I ask that give wisely, but if you don't have any money, don't worry about it. The amount of funds you have should never, ever stand in the way of you getting access to the Dhamma. So, we are in the second of three talks on the Four Noble Truths, the center, the absolute foundation of the Buddha's insight, the core teachings, the profound, one of the most profound insights that the Buddha had. Just to review what I talked about last week, and we covered a lot of ground, so I'm sort of going to go over it quickly, but if any of you weren't there, you sort of need to have this reviewed, and even for those of you who were here, you might need to just be refreshed. So, if there's any core observation underlying Buddhist thought, it's the idea of karma, which is that the mind is basically all the things we experience are caused. Almost all the things we experience are caused. We don't experience things by accident, nor are they just things that happen to arise. Generally, what we experience is caused, and the mind states that we experience, the stress, the happiness, the worry, the anxiety, the fear, the things that we experience are much more than we ever expect caused by our own thoughts and our own actions. We tend to believe that, or we tend to blame the outside world on the way we feel, the way we think, what we experience, but actually our lasting states of worry, our states of self-centeredness, our states of stress, our states of calm, and our states of happiness, these are caused states, caused by our own unskillful and skillful actions. The Buddha went on to say that the skillful thoughts are generally ones that are about not causing harm to other beings and are about cultivating thoughts that encourage the idea that there's nothing missing from our lives, that we're not missing anything to achieve happiness. Such thoughts like generosity or gratitude. When we experience generosity and gratitude, we're not coming from a place of feeling deprived or missing. We're coming from a place of abundance in life. So these types of thoughts are skillful, and they give birth to skillful peace and serenity. On the other hand, when we live in thoughts that are predicated in the idea that there's something missing, that I've got to attain it, that I've got to grab it and fill up my life, my experience with something that I don't have, these are thoughts of craving. These are thoughts like, if only I had this person or that thing, if only I got rid of that person or that thing, if only I achieved such and such a state that I'm not in right now, that I then could be happy. But right now, I can't be happy because there's something missing. That's a delusional state. And that's also a state that causes the stress. Now, we also went on to talk about I went on to talk about, and you sat there, hopefully listening. The idea that when we're very young, when we're children, we train ourselves to answer every uncomfortable state that arises in the body by going out into the world around us and seeking something that will answer. For example, when we feel hungry, we look out for food. Makes sense. When we're cold, we look out in the world for a blanket or warm clothes. When we feel exposed and vulnerable, we look for shelter. So there's nothing wrong with this tendency when it comes to those kind of internal states. We all need food to a certain degree. We need shelter. We need clothes to keep us warm. We need medicine when we're sick. So to a certain degree, looking to the outside world for solutions to what we're feeling inside of the body is a skillful thing. But we tend to take this habit of searching in the outside world for the answers to our inner discomfort way too far. So when we experience a sense of emptiness or a sense of discomfort, the mind will then translate and say, oh, I'm lonely, or oh, I'm lost in life, or oh, I'm I don't compare well to others, or oh, I don't have enough, or whatever. It translates an underlying embodied state of discomfort into a series of thoughts, and then we jump out into the world looking for the solution. So there's this constant trying to fill up what's going on inside our own skin by diverting ourselves with diversions, basically. The things we attach to in the outside world, the Buddha said, they generally have a couple of characteristics that we should consider. One, they're conditional. They depend upon things well beyond our means of control. If our happiness is conditioned upon other people approving of everything we do, of pleasing other people, we're fucked. We're in trouble. That's bad news. Why? Because the Buddha said there'll be people who criticize you for talking too much. There'll be people who criticize you at the same time saying you talk too little. And there'll be people who criticize you even if you talk exactly the right amount. So once you sign up for finding your happiness from other people's approval, you're basically signing up for the misery of when people don't approve of what you say or do. It's not a good source for lasting happiness. Nor is fame a good sense of lasting happiness, because no matter how famous you get, you'll wind up eventually obscure. Nor is monetary gain a good, or material gain, a good sense place to find happiness, because, guess what? It can go away. Any of you read the stories of people who once had millions and then had nothing in the blink of an eye a few years ago? This happens all the time. People, and even if you did manage to accumulate a large amount of money and the money didn't go away, it wouldn't answer anything. You'd get bored of it after a while, and you'd still feel that inner sense of emptiness or discomfort that you were trying to fill up with the outside world. It doesn't work. That endless search of things out there to fill something that's going on inside of us doesn't work. Doesn't work. So, the Buddha said it's conditional, and therefore our source of happiness has a tendency to go away. He also says it can tend to be very blameworthy, in the sense that when our happiness comes from consuming, we tend to consume the world. We tend to consume the things around us. We tend to exploit the people around us and consume all the resources. Trying to fill ourselves up with happiness tends to create a blameworthy mode of happiness. And we are, even if we're not aware of it at certain points in our life, we can become aware of it and we can feel a sense of doubt and guilt and a sense of alienation from our own lives at one point when we realize the toll that our addictions for things are taking. So not only is finding happiness always externally bad news because it's impermanent, but also it's blameworthy. And at the end of the day, the Buddha says it's also dukkha. There's also stress there because since it's changing, we all know that we have to constantly stay on guard, looking after our money, looking after our the things we have, protecting it, making sure it's there. I've done hospice work, visiting people and hospices, not as much as my friend Bob at his center, but when you do, you'll be surprised at how many people, while near death, are still worried about how much money they have. It's pretty stunning. So there's a sense of stress, a sense of impermanence. It's conditional. It's not sturdy. It's nothing you can depend upon. So, in other words, another way of looking at this is we all live in a whole bunch of worlds. We live in the external world where we're trying to find our happiness with other people, often getting in our way, not doing the things we want them to do, not participating in what we think is the best way for us to be happy. Then we also have our imaginary worlds, our expectations of the way we think things should be, our views and opinions. We have our daydreams of what we could be doing right now. Oh, I don't have to be here. I could be eating my dinner. I should be at home watching TV. We have our ruminations about the past. So we have our imaginary worlds. And finally, we have the world that we overlook the most, but it's the source of our most lasting happiness. And that is our internal world. What's going on in our own skin? That's where we almost invariably try to avoid the most. We try to treat our internal world, what it feels like in our own skin, what the breath feels like, what our body feels like. We try to treat that as something to get rid of. We just fill it up with food. Once in a while, we indulge it with sex. But most of the time, we're living outside of our own skin, searching around outside, trying to make the perfect conditions out there in the world so that we can feel good in our own skin. You can, if you think about it, you can see what a failed premise it is, trying to make everything out there perfect so that we can feel good in here. It's a paradox. It doesn't work. So, that's the core of craving and how it causes stress and suffering. We're trying to answer something in the wrong place. We're trying to find happiness in the wrong place. And rather than answering our need for happiness and inner peace, it causes more and more stress because we're attaching to something, a relationship, a job, a family member, a sense of how much money we have, a sense of how we compare to others. We're attaching to one story and it starts to go away. We freak out. We become obsessed sometimes with trying to make it work. And then when it doesn't, we jump to something else. And so we keep jumping around looking for a lasting source of happiness until we finally have midlife crises or nervous breakdowns, or a great state of overwhelmedness where we, not that that's a word, but it sounded like one for a moment, we are overwhelmed. So, the good news, though, is just as our stress and suffering is something that is created, there is a state called Nirodha, which is the third noble truth, and that is there is an ending of stress and suffering. That's what I'm going to be talking about. There is an ending of stress and suffering, and it has very, very many, or a lot of different levels, and it finally, if you release all of your stress and suffering, you reach a state called enlightenment, nibbana. So for your own enjoyment, I have actually made a roadmap to enlightenment for you. Now, I didn't know there would be... I also, at work, could only sneak making 40 copies, so everybody will have to share. If you don't get a chance to view this, or if you want to bring it home but you don't get to, don't worry. There is online a follower of the monk Ajahn Jeff has posted a variation of this chart on Wikipedia. If you look up jhana, J-H-A-N-A, which means the state, a state that leads to enlightenment. So wait as people pass this. So, if you, when you get this, or if you can look over your friend's shoulder, there you go. In our day-to-day lives, which is the first column, we're walking around in a state which has what's known as the five hindrances. We're moving between realms of, or thoughts that are based on craving, thoughts that are based on aversion, wishing something would go away. We're walking around with a state of agitation and worry. And we're walking around with a state of tiredness and feeling overwhelmed. And finally, there's also self-doubt. Sure, happiness might be possible for everybody else, but it's not possible for me. So those are known as the five hindrances, and those are the states that we're generally in on a day-to-day basis. We're walking around, jumping from these points of view. And while we're in it, the skillful thoughts that we were developing during meditation, where we were focusing the thoughts on breathing and relaxing the body, and how we could be skillful with our thoughts, keeping our mind focused on an area that doesn't cause stress. For example, how to make the breath comfortable is a thing that doesn't cause stress. It brings a sense of ease. So we're generally not thinking that kind of thought when we're at work. We're generally worried, trying to make a deadline. We're concerned about what other people think about us. We're worried about how much we've got on our plate. We're living in the future. We're living in anxieties of the past. So we've got all this stuff going on, and skillful, relaxed thought that helps us relieve our stress isn't there. Nor is the other states of feeling comfortable in the body, or feeling a sense of joy that lasts in the mind, and a sense of equanimity, which is a state of not really overreacting to what's going on around us. Equanimity is being basically balanced, so that we feel so good inside our own skin that we don't overreact to everything that's going on in the world. Now, just as we did in meditation, you see this second row where it says skillful thoughts, sustained focused thought. That's what we did when we kept on saying, let's focus the mind, ask the body what feels good breathing, what kind of breath feels good, how we can use the thoughts to keep our mind focused on the breath. The Buddha called these vitakka and vikara, and these are what we develop in the Eightfold Path, which is the fourth noble truth. We learn how to do these and how to sustain these skillful thoughts. We create a state where we can use our thoughts as skillfully as possible to not focus on things that cause suffering, but instead focus on things that cause peace. For instance, not only the breath and relaxing the body, but there's also thinking thoughts of goodwill to ourselves and others, thinking thoughts of generosity and gratitude, thinking thoughts of appreciation of all the skillful things we've done to help others in our life, thinking thoughts of forgiveness, letting go of old grudges that continually flood the mind. All of these kinds of thoughts are thoughts that don't give birth to stress. They give birth to a sense of ease. Now, in this case, we're following the Buddha's Anapanasati all the way to enlightenment. So this is the way enlightenment looks, and there's nothing mystical about enlightenment, by the way. Enlightenment is actually a powerful, profound state, and I do not claim to be enlightened, please. I'm going by what my teacher has taught, who is enlightened, but I'm not. I've in retreats been in the jhana states, which are the states from the first to the fourth, but I do not in any way, shape, or form claim enlightenment. That's for sure. So, in fact, I won't even talk about what states I've been in personally because that's considered to be bad form. But anyway, so we use, as you see, we use the skillful states to get us into the jhanas, and then they create a sense of joy in the mind, a sense of peace and ease in the body, and a sense of equanimity, a sense of calm balance with whatever arises. Eventually, the breath becomes so permeating of the body and the mind that we no longer need any thought, and we allow the thoughts to go. We allow them just to recede. So all we have now are the joy in the mind, the peace in the body, and the equanimity. Eventually, the joy, the joyful thoughts, oh, this is so great, the joyful, like, oh, I'm in the jhanas, this is so wonderful, this sense of mindful joy, this begins to subside, and we relax simply into the two last states, which are a state of ease and pleasure in the body and a state of mindful equanimity. So we're still feel very calm and at ease in our body, and we also feel a sense of non-reactiveness to everything that's going around, not only outside of us, but the things that are coming up in us. Sometimes there'll be a body sensation that feels painful or feels good. We won't react. We don't react. We just watch, we observe, but we don't try to push away or cling. Finally, even the sense of the breath fully filling up the body begins to recede, and the body no longer begins to be the center of our focus anymore. We begin to have a mind that doesn't only focus on the body, it focuses on everything that's arising. There's no longer a sense of inner and outer or a sense of the breath filling up the body. It's just a sense of relaxing into, a sense of letting go. At this point, we're in the final fourth jhana, which is not yet technically enlightenment. We are just in the state of equanimity, which is, I say just, if you ever get there, you should give a hallelujah chorus, because very, very few human beings ever attain the fourth jhana. It generally states that people who practice for many, 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 many years, people who are renunciates, attain. And if you get there, you've attained a state that is so profound, because you're basically in a state of awareness where you feel completely relaxed and easeful, but you're no longer in any way stressed by anything that's arising or passing or anything like that. There's still, though, technically, to have that state of equanimity still requires a little bit of exertion. So the final last moment is when we let go and we fall into this unconditioned so-called deathless state of enlightenment. And it's important because this is the only state in the mind that is not caused. Everything that leads up to enlightenment is caused by our skillful actions. But once we get to equanimity, where we are truly at peace with everything that's occurring, even that state of being of equanimity requires a little bit of sustaining or a little bit of effort. We let go and we fall into a state. And I'm going to read you, the Buddha rarely talked about exactly what Nibbana or enlightenment feels like, but I'm going to read you his quote about it, which is, I think, really moving. He said, "One who finds enlightenment is peaceful, calm, wishing nothing, and is completely harmless. One is unlimited in all directions. One is untroubled by and unconcerned with the past and the future. One is pure and unshakable, beyond uncertainty and doubt. One is confident. One is clear-seeing and freed from all stress and suffering." Sounds pretty good. "This spiritual practitioner enters into the final state, which is the cooling off of all cravings, the stilling of all mental agitation, the releasing and relinquishing of all we are attached to. It is without end. It is silent. It is free. It is a blissfully peaceful state. It is Nibbana." So that's that final state. That's what all the renunciates are seeking when they let go of all their everything they own and they take up the robes and the bowl. I've never been the one to ask, but I've been at many retreats where monks are asked, "Well, how could you give up sex, for example? Give up, you know, all the things that are renounced." There's 216 rules that of what the monks in the Theravada tradition give up. And every single monk has said, if you've ever experienced enlightenment, you know that it is every other form of happiness that people attain is a shallow shadow in comparison. That there's nothing in comparison to the state of letting go of everything we're worried about, everything we unskillfully focus our mind on, all the places that we look at happiness in the wrong place. There's this great sense of the mind being just endless, without limit. And everything it encounters, it doesn't worry about, it doesn't push away, it doesn't attach to, it simply is at peace with. So it's obviously a very, very, very profound, wonderful state. The Buddha said that even if we don't attain final enlightenment, which is the last stop on the train, just the process of you see here of these steps where we're letting go of the hindrances, where we're in skillful thought, then we're letting go of skillful thought and we're experiencing the joy in the mind and the pleasure in the body. These are something we should experience, because the more we experience an inner sense of ease that's not conditioned upon unskillful things, trying to control the people around us, trying to accumulate wealth to fill up our emptiness. When we really experience this form of happiness, it gives us motivation to keep practicing, to keep pushing ourselves, to keep furthering so that we can wind up in even more profound states. Now, even if you don't wind up in enlightenment, it's not so much important as the more you develop a peaceful internal state where you feel comfortable in your own skin, you're not going to addict yourself to the things that obsess the mind. You're not going to cause yourself stress and suffering. You cause yourself stress and suffering simply by looking for happiness and peace and security in the wrong places. These are the right places. This is where true happiness, this is exactly how lasting peace is found. So that's the third noble truth. Next week, I'm going to talk about the fourth noble truth, which are the ways we, the eight things we practice to get into this state of jhana, or this state where we've conquered the hindrances that cause us stress, we've conquered our cravings and our aversions, the eight skillful factors that the Buddha taught that result in this path to inner peace and finally enlightenment. So thanks for listening to this roadmap to enlightenment, and now it's your turn to ask any questions or share any confusion, doubt, or anything like that. Thanks. Hi.